The composer Terrence Blanchard has been doing the music for Spike Lee's films for 30 years now. So they know each other's work, and Blanchard knows what Lee expects from him. He doesn't want synthetic instruments, for example. Lee communicates what he wants in tone and color. So Blanchard says he has to get that from the orchestra and from instrument clusters. And he says composing for Spike Lee is like being passed the ball by LeBron James in the final seconds of a game. You've got to sink the shot. Take their latest collaboration, the film The Five Bloods. Blanchard's score for The Five Bloods was nominated for an Academy Award this year. It's the story of four black Vietnam vets who return to Vietnam to find the remains of the squadron leader who was killed. And there's also some treasure they're hoping to recover. Edmund Stone is the host of the public radio show The Score. He'll pick up the story from there.
They're having a good time. They're seeing old friends, perhaps having a drink or two. This is just a hail fellow, well-met kind of opening. But then you start to see them take the journey from the city down the river in a small boat towards the area they need to get to in the jungle. You begin to notice that the jungle becomes more of a presence. If you've ever walked through a jungle, as I have in Africa, you understand that the next step, the next tree, is the most important part of your trip that day. And so they are now confronting both the almost impenetrable jungle, but also the memories, the flashbacks to what it was like 45 years earlier when they were young men fighting for their country. Terrence Blanchard is a superhuman being, a very kind, hardworking man, and it's a powerful score because I just think The Five Bloods has such a strong resonation with everybody who knows anything at all about the conflict in Vietnam and what happened afterwards with American servicemen. It will disturb some people, I think. If you're a former military person, you know what you went through, you know what happened, you came back, and this will bring back memories. But for these five people, the film was all about how do you reconcile with your feelings, with your memories, and how do you talk about it?
What did Blanchard tell you about the time he first watched the scene when it all came together?
That he had to stop and dry his eyes. I mean, I'm almost tearing up at the thought of that now, because when you get so emotionally involved in a scene that you have to compose, you have to separate yourself from that scene because you have a job to do. But for Terrence, it was overpowering. It was overpowering.
That is the beauty of music, isn't it? To be able to evoke these powerful emotions, sometimes painful emotions. I guess that's one of the things you appreciate about music and these musical scores for these films.
Well, we always talk about what does music do for a film? And when I ask composers this question, I've done that many, many times in the score, the answer is almost the same. There's two slightly different answers. One is that it does move the emotional context of a film forward from scene to scene. And the other answer is the music can also tell you the emotion you should be feeling at that moment. But the one thing a score should never do is get in the way of a film. And all five nominations this year do just that. If you listen to them separately, they stand alone. But there are some scores where sometimes the music is so strong, it overpowers the action on the screen. or overpowers the scene or overpowers the emotion. And my own litmus test is if ever I'm watching a movie, Doug, and I've noticed the music for the first time, it might be the wrong music for me. I don't want to notice the music, but I don't want to miss the music. Do you know what I'm trying to say? It has to be there in the background, but it must not get in the way of the reason you went to see that film in the first place. In my experience in Africa, in the jungle, was always that the jungle wins. The jungle has powers, deadly powers, if you don't treat it with respect. And I think the memory of the jungle for the Five Bloods is so strong that it takes them back to the moment when they were dropped into the jungle. And I think we can understand this. If you're a person who's never been in a jungle before and now you're in a war in a jungle, you don't have any idea what to expect because you don't understand that terrain. For these men, when they were first serving in Vietnam, this is probably their very first time ever outside their country of United States of America. So this was a brand new experience, which quickly becomes a terrifying one, which you then see over and over again in the flashbacks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Edmund Stone is with us for the hour, taking us through the Academy Award nominees for Best Original Score. Along with To Five Bloods, there's Mank, there's News of the World, Minari, and there's Soul. Last year, the film industry was defined by the same thing that pretty much defined everything else in the world, the pandemic. But Stone told us it's actually opened doors for the film industry that weren't really used much before.
I'm talking about streaming.
Yeah.
As a film reviewer, as a professional film reviewer, and a host of The Score, I've not actually been in a movie theater now since last March. So for me, it's been observing movies through my own systems, my computer at home, my television set. What that has done is that it has shown us two things. First, that Hollywood is nothing if not resilient in bringing the movies to you in whatever way it can. The second thing is the unknown. What is going to happen when movies open? Are we going to be comfortable going back into a 500, 600, 700-seat auditorium to watch a movie? There are some movies that I think you should see on the big screen. But we're going to talk about one today, actually. And there are some films that you're okay seeing it on the small screen. But I think the problem with streaming is only that you must enjoy the movie in the context of watching a movie and not be distracted by other things, lawnmowers, dogs needing to come in and go out, and that. So that's what we're going to have to get used to. Yeah. And the other thing is the business side of movie making. It's very hard when you spend $200 million, as Hollywood sometimes does, on a film, and then have to realize, how am I going to get my money back if I can't put it into the theater? I might be able to get back on streaming. Let's take an example of the new Bond film. I understand that they are paying heavy prices on the money they borrowed to make that film. The interest rates accrue every day, but you're not going to get that money back until you release the film once and for all, and it hasn't been released yet.
It's interesting, too, that three of the five nominated scores for the films, Minari, Soul, The Five Bloods, they're a reflection of a different culture. They have a cultural perspective that might be different. Do you think that's where we might be headed in film to some degree?
About 3 years ago, on stage, picking up her Academy Award, an actress actually talked about this. Inclusivity is what Frances McDormand talked about. And this year, I think, we're seeing far more inclusivity. We're seeing it in the performances. We're seeing it in the directors. And we're seeing it in the choice of films being considered. And we're seeing it in the music being created for these films. We are looking at a different age. And my connections in my contacts in the composing field in Hollywood have always said this. We would like to shake things up. We would like to have an off-the-wall score suddenly be considered, perhaps a more modern score suddenly being considered. We're not saying we don't want to have symphonic scores. I think there's always going to be a very good purpose to have a symphonic score if it's appropriate for the film. But that doesn't mean you can't rule out electronic scores or jazz-based scores or minimalist scores. It's just whatever works for the film. Just don't ask a creative person like a composer to be boxed in to a certain kind of style and not be able to flex their muscles. Yeah.
Well, we'll come back to this in a moment, but it is interesting. We should maybe mention how jazz is featured prominently this year in some of the nominated music. It's one of the kind of unique characteristics you see in some of these films.
I have not seen so much jazz-influenced scores for a very long time, certainly in the Academy Awards and possibly in Hollywood. Don't forget that we went away from jazz scores around the 1960s, 1970s. And it's always been around there. It's always been in the peripheral vision of score composers. But usually it's been in the form of a cue, Doug, perhaps a scene, perhaps two or three scenes, perhaps a motif for a character. But this year, as you said, we're seeing it dominate the entire soundtrack, and that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing.
Well, let's break down some of these films. Let's start with News of the World. We talked about The Five Bloods. Let's talk about News of the World, film adapted from the Paulette Giles book. It's about a veteran named Jefferson Kyle Kidd. Travels the country in the years after the Civil War. He reads news to people as a living. Comes to care for this 10-year-old girl who had been taken by the Kiowa people. Returning her to her aunt and her uncle, he has to cross, of course, the plains of Texas. It's directed by Paul Greengrass. Let's talk about James Newton Howard. He's the composer for this film.
Well, James Newton Howard has a stunning background in Hollywood. He started out as a musician, working with some great musical acts over years. Then went back into, never really left film scoring, but really came back into scoring, left for a while to become a lecturer in film music in London. And when you look at his track record, we're looking at Liar, Liar. We're looking at The Dark Knight, Charlie Wilson's War. Amazing films. So he does this wonderful film, which is the only true, real sort of symphonic orchestral score this year being nominated. And it's a beautiful score. It reminds me of the score that Carter Burwell created for True Grit, which actually was set in the same period, at the same time, similar characters in the same geographical area. And so what you have is this beautiful, almost background, incidental music to what's going on screen. In the case of News of the World, that music is used very sparingly and always to the best possible effect.
I read was that the way the director Paul Greengrass had described what he wanted for that music in his conversations with Howard was a broken score for a broken country. Say a little bit about that, because this is a Western, but Howard hasn't given in, I think you've said, to the stereotype of what a Western might be. You do have a sense that it is, because that does sound familiar in the score, but it's not, I think, a cliche. Is how you put it.
Well, I think what you're doing is you're doing what sometimes used to be referred to as writing against the scene. There used to be a tendency that whenever you saw somebody on a horse, you had to write that kind of clippity-cloppity music. And there was a rejection that just because a scene is telling you something doesn't mean you have to write the music that the audience expects. In fact, it's better if you don't. Think about your favorite horror film. Sometimes the music doesn't come in at all during the worst possible horror scenes. It's more effective if you don't go along with the lure, as it were, in the water and bite it. Let the music come in when you least expect it, and let it be a different tone. But in the case of News of the World, it's always there. You just don't have to pay attention to it all the time.
One of the things I saw that Howard had said is that the more he watched the film as he was scoring it, the more he said he felt like it might be a sermon, and that there was some idea of solemnity that he tried to convey. What is the kind of, I guess, characteristic or theme or style of the music? Are you hearing that, I suppose, is what I want to ask.
Yeah, you're hearing Samba. Samba starts at the very beginning, actually, with a cue which is called Now for Some Federal News. Tom Hanks' character is reading the newspaper to local communities that are paying a few coins for that privilege. And he does it so well because he's able to be more dramatic in his readings, with his use of his glasses and peering closely to the typeface. And he's talking about the cholera cases in the nearby towns. He's talking about the good news that is coming out with the federal government and going into its own directions after the Civil War. He's got the stage. There is a somber element to newsprint and the way news is understood in those days. And Newton Howard can do this with this almost omnipresent kind of lower strings, minor keys, to underscore the fact that you're curious to know what's going on in the world, but on the other hand, you'd rather not because it's going to be depressing.
Edmund Stone. He's host of the public radio show The Score in Portland, Oregon. The 93rd Academy Awards are this Sunday night. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Using your smart speaker, starting your day with NPR Utah has never been easier. All you have to do is tell it to play KUER, and we'll be there throughout your morning with news and the latest Utah stories.
Now, the state of Utah has made an important move in this controversial issue. It's the first state in the country to protect.
That's KUER on your smart speaker. Just tell it to play KUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It's Oscar season, if you care, and some of you really do. Our contribution is going to be focused on the music. We're profiling the five original scores nominated for the Academy Awards ceremony airing on Sunday. And our guest is the music expert and scholar Edmund Stone. He hosts a terrific program called The Score. So let's talk about the film Soul. The co-director of the film, Kemp Power, has said that the jazz itself is almost like another character in this film. Soul is this animated Walt Disney Pixar feature. It's about this middle school teacher named Joe Gardner, and his passion is jazz. And we won't give too much away here, but something happens where his soul gets separated from his body. And maybe, Edmundson, we should talk about those two different worlds, because it seems like those are reflected in the music we hear in this film.
Yeah, Joe finds himself in a worldly plane called the Great Before, where souls go to find their purpose and passion in life. If there are two elements going on in the movie, the aspects of the film taking place in this other world and the aspects of the film taking place in the real world in New York City, you've also got the two elements of music working that way too. You've got John Batiste, a brilliant musician and band leader. he was brought in to create compositions, original compositions that Joe would play, because Joe wants to be his real passion is to work in a jazz club. And he finally gets that opportunity, and then unfortunately things happen. But he never loses that love of wanting to be in a jazz combo and play the piano.
So we have John Batiste talk about the other part of the music written by the musicians Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross.
Totally different from, if we say, who are Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross? They were part of Nine Inch Nails. And you'd say, what? Did you just say what I think you just said? and they became composers. Atticus Ross and Trent Reznor first came to prominence in movie music with The Social Network, which they won the Academy Award for. But that was a very synth electronic driven score, as you would expect for a subject like that. And here they are with soul in a totally, totally different direction. It's like sitting in a garden chair on a warm summer's evening, sipping lemonade. It's just so comfortable. You just could be there all the time. Some composers are so good at changing the clothes they are wearing when they're creating music. There's one more thing, though, about soul, is the blending of the two, the blending of the ethereal music with the jazz. And you would say, there's no way in black and white, cold reality you could do that. Because essentially you're thinking, well, that's jazz and that is celestial music. How do they go together? They go very, very well when it's in the hands of Pixar and these three guys.
Let's talk about Mank. It's a film directed by David Fincher, set in the 1930s, Hollywood, about the screenwriter Herman Mankiewicz and, of course, his attempt to develop and write the screenplay for Citizen Kane. And we have to bring up Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross again. They were they're the composers for this film, too. How unique is that, by the way, Edmund Stone, that you have composers nominated for two different films in a year?
It has not happened very often in recent film score history. It happened many, many years ago when they were first considering scores for Academy Awards in the 30s and 40s. You'd often see Max Steiner against himself, because in those days they had up to 10 nominees for best score. But I think it's only happened once in the last, let's say, 10 years. I don't think that's going to happen this time. We talked earlier about how you can adapt a style, and what they have done, what Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross has done with Mank is absolutely phenomenal. It is such an homage to late 1930s, early 1940s music.
Edmund, break down a few of these cues from the film. Start with Election Night Victory. This is one that you've teased out for us that I think you say really conveys the 30s and early 40s.
Election Night Victory is a pivotal scene in Mank. There is the election of the governor of California taking place, and a lot of the activity for the election of the governor is taking place in Los Angeles. And it happens to be that Louis B. Mayer and Randolph Hearst want a particular candidate to win, and Mankiewicz wants the opponent to win. So So here we are in the election night hall, as it were, waiting for the results to come in. And it started to go in the favor of MGM's candidate and Randolph Hearst's candidate, and against who Mankiewicz wants. And he starts to see it slipping further and further away. And there is this jazzy saxophone, jazzy number, which is so wonderfully typical of a period around 1940, 1941. It's just kind of sad because you realize that Mank doesn't really have any power at all. He's already having to share screen credit on his best screenplay with Orson Welles. And he's already an alcoholic, seriously impaired by his alcoholism. And you just start to see Hollywood slipping away from him.
What are you hearing here, Edmund Stein?
I'm there, Doug. I am at the Coconut Grove in the Ambassador Hotel. I've got my tux on, and I'm just sipping, can I say this, that I'm actually sipping a non-alcoholic martini. And just I'm dancing with my wife, and we're having a wonderful time. The palm trees are swaying, and it's a good time to have a good time.
To have you talk about a particular cue called All This Time, which gives us a sense about, I guess, the process for, I mean, Citizen Kane, people think of it as the greatest film ever made, and the process behind it. What does All This Time as music do for this process of writing this, you know, what some people think to be this masterpiece?
It is a masterpiece. And in all honesty, I think you can see Mank without having seen Citizen Kane, but how much better it would be if you could see them both back to back, because then you'd understand a lot more about being in the moment of being part of the entire machinery that was going around for Citizen Kane. What we're seeing here is finally the screenplay is delivered. But there was discord between Orson Welles and Mankiewicz. Orson Welles believed, and he had given Mankiewicz every resource. He knew he was brilliant. He knew he could deliver a massive screenplay, an important screenplay, in almost no time at all. He gave him the tools to do it, even allowed him to have some booze along the way. But at the same time, the script was absolutely brilliant. And then Mankiewicz decides he wants a screen credit, which he'd already told Orson Welles he didn't want a screen credit. So Orson Welles is very upset that we'd have to share screen credit because he was also working on the screenplay for the rewrites. And it won the Academy Award for Citizen Kane for screenplay. But neither Orson Welles nor Mankiewicz were in the room to receive the award. Both were given their awards at separate places in the world, and both were critical of each other's participation. So really, at the end of this film, you realize it's the perfect summary of what has happened before. After all this time, nothing has really been resolved. Mankiewicz is a brilliant writer. Orson Welles is just an amazing person, but they clash. Their egos just get in the way of everything else. And although the film gets made and becomes potentially the best film ever made by Hollywood, it leaves a lot of scars and wounds along the way.
Edmund Stone. His radio program is called The Score. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
This is Rachel Martin with Morning Edition. If you're driving less these days and you've got a car you don't need anymore, consider donating it to support public radio. The donation could be worth hundreds of dollars in support for this station. Here's how to get started.
KUER accepts all kinds of vehicles, including SUVs, trucks, RVs, and even boats. Plus, the process is easy. We'll handle everything from the free pickup to the donation receipt. You can get started at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Edmund Stone. He's host of the radio program The Score. And he's taking us through the five original music scores nominated for the Academy Awards, which is airing on Sunday night. Final film of the five soundtracks nominated this year is for Minari. It's a film written and directed by Lee Isaac Chung, who's known around here in Utah, graduated from film studies at the University of Utah, so we claim him a bit. The film has been described as semi-autobiographical. It's about a Korean-American family that moves to this farm in Arkansas in the 1980s, and it's about place and it's about family. One of the storylines in the film is this relationship between the young boy, David, and his grandmother, and I wanted to start there because she takes him to this place by a creek to plant some seeds. And it seems like a powerful moment and a powerful metaphor for the film. Maybe let's start there.
Yes, she is brought in from Korea to help the family. And when she comes in from Korea, she's bringing with her some seeds, which are Minari seeds. Minari is a plant which is very popular in Korea. It's a little like parsley. And the idea becomes, if we plant this parsley on this new farm we've just acquired, we can generate a trade with people that would enjoy it like we do in Korea. And the little boy is not at all happy with his grandmother. First of all, he doesn't know her very well. She is very Korean in her ways. He is a little boy who's grown up in California, so he's not aware of a lot of the Korean customs, and he doesn't think of her. I mean, there's one line when he says, "You're not like a real grandmother." And she says, "Why?" He says, "Well, because you don't bake cookies," you know, which I think sums it all up. And there's this there's a little bit distance, and he has to sleep in the same room with his grandmother, which doesn't please him at all. But slowly over time, they become very close, and she becomes the grandmother that he never had. And he, as you say, they go down to the creek, and on the side of the creek, which is the only basic water source in the area, the entire film is about trying to make it in Arkansas, where there's no water. They can't raise their crops. They don't have any water, but the creek is there, and you know it becomes the sort of central theme that the Minari and the creek are one, and that the grandmother and the parents and the children are one. You said it very well, Doug, when you set the scene up by saying it's about family. The mother and the father are always arguing because she doesn't think they're doing the right thing, and he wants to hang in there a bit longer and make it, do something once in his life, he says, to make it as a family. The children are put off by the arguments that are going on. In fact, there's a beautiful little moment where the couple are fighting and the children are in their room making paper airplanes. And they're writing on the airplanes, "Please don't fight, please don't fight." And they throw the airplanes into the middle of the argument and then run away. That's the only way they can connect to their parents and say, "This is hurting us, please stop fighting." If you were to put three things together in this film, it would be the grandmother, the creek, and the Minari plant. They are the glue that holds this family together.
nominated music for the film was composed by Emile Mosseri. What can you say about his work? He's an American composer, I guess.
Yes, he is. He made his feature film score debut at the Sundance Festival about 2 years ago with a film called The Last Black Man in San Francisco. And basically, he's been gaining a bit more traction ever since. This is his first Academy Award nomination.
One of the things Mosseri has said about this film is that he and the director, Chung, decided that the score shouldn't be overtly Korean, they said, or it shouldn't be overtly American in style. What was the balance they were trying to strike there then?
Well, the most important thing to think about that part is that Emil started to create the music before the film was shot. So when you do that, first of all, you have something for the cast to listen to as they're rehearsing, as they're preparing. That's always a very, it sounds like a logical thing. It's not. A very few composers have been permitted or had the ability to create a score before a film is shot. Ennio Morricone did sometimes. He certainly did on The Hateful Eight. But it's rare. And when you do that, you're kind of sort of boxing yourself in. Because although you can easily, not easily perhaps, but although you can rescore a section of a score, you've kind of taken a step in a direction that you have to now complete. You've now decided what you want that film to sound like. And you have to hope that the producers and the director goes along with it. So I think what we're seeing here is an idea that came from the director, of course. It is based a lot on his own story of coming from a different part of the country and then settling somewhere else with his parents to farm. And I think what we're seeing with Minari is, yes, they are from Korea, and yes, they do use Korean language in the film too with subtitles. And yes, there is elements of Korean music in it, but it's not a Korean film. It's an American film. It's an American-Korean film with some subtitles. And I think it's wonderful. Let's go back to being what we talked about at the very beginning of this program, which is inclusivity. If you stop and look back at these five categories, these five nominees, in the majority of cases, you would have to say, Hollywood is finally walking the walk and talking the talk. Yes, they have a long way to go, but every major journey is taken with a big step in the beginning, and this is one of them.
Tell us, I wanted to tee up at least two cues here. Grandma Picked a Good Spot. Talk about that piece.
The young children say this towards the conclusion of the film, when they realize that even though things are going badly, even though their dream, their American dream, seems to be crumbling in front of their eyes with their hard work and effort, what they decided to do to create this crop is working. And Grandma was the one who chose that particular place to plant those seeds. And they're growing. They're starting to harvest it at the end of the film. And Grandma Picked a Good Spot is calm and contemplative. Those are the words I wrote when I first heard this cue. Calm and contemplative. There's enough drama to scare us about trying to become farmers in Arkansas in the 1980s. Trying to find water where there isn't any. Just trying to get by. But this somehow is that reassurance that there is still hope. We can still hope for good. Thank you.
it's interesting hearing that piece. It's Mosseri has mentioned doubling his piano with this detuned acoustic guitar. And I guess you're hearing it there, that kind of earthy feel there, that double piano sound.
We're so used, I think, in music to hearing a beautiful instrument playing in perfect tune. And yet there are some composers that I applaud who like to actually detune a piano if it's relevant to a scene. I'm thinking now of films set in the West. It's not unusual these days to hear a piano playing in a saloon in circa 1880 Arizona, which is out of tune. Well, because it would be out of tune.
Right.
No one's going to go around from small community on the stagecoach to tune a piano. So, I think when you do something like this, and taking it back a bit, I think, these are ordinary people in Mosseri trying to do an extraordinary thing called survival against nature. And of course, everything's going to be a little bit odd, a little bit perhaps astringent from time to time. The weather, and there's a scene in Mosseri where there's a tornado warning, and they're arguing about whether they should leave or sit it out. I mean, this is something they've never heard of before. And so hearing that music with a detuned guitar and an upright piano, again, it's the perfect choice. I mean, we don't think about that when we're hearing music. We just hear the music and react to it. We don't think about the process that goes into creating that particular sound. I remember the story in Ben-Hur, when Miklos Rocha was in Rome scoring Ben-Hur in 1959 and knew there were no Roman instruments. There were no instruments from the first century AD. They didn't exist. So what he had to do to create the sound was to look at the statues, look at the mosaics, and where there were instruments portrayed in mosaics from the time, he had musicians build them and then use them in the score. Now, that's something you wouldn't need to know about when you're hearing the great music of Ben-Hur. And yet, to an authenticity point of view, it was absolutely essential to try to get as close as possible to the emotional moment with that instrument that you could get with. And he does that with this. It's a little bit off key because the characters are a little bit off. I mean, the grandma is a bit off key.
Let's talk about Jacob's Prayer, because there's an element here I wanted to ask you about. It's these wordless vocals and the way he employs them in this piece and throughout the film, I have to say. Talk about that.
What do wordless vocals do? They're taking the human voice, which is the number one instrument, the first instrument, and they're using the human voice as a bridge to the orchestra by harmonizing the human voice but not giving it any words. So it's almost like being in, shall we say, a store or a garden, and humming to yourself. You're hearing that sound in your head, and that sound is telling you how you want to feel at that moment, because you've drawn it out of your mind, out of your recollection. And I think Jacob's Prayer comes in and goes out throughout the film. It's not a particular scene. It transitions throughout the film. It's a thread that connects moments and characters and feelings. It's like a comfortable pair of shoes, always there. You know, you can think about the problems of your shirt being tight or having the wrong pants on, but that comfortable pair of shoes will ground you into at least a good feeling.
Edmund, say something about Rain Song. Do you want to say something about Rain Song?
Yeah, Rain Song is a piece that comes in. It's actually sung by the lead actress in the movie. There are two versions of it. Unfortunately, they didn't release the English version, which I think would have been nice to have both versions, the Korean version and the English version. But it's a lullaby. And it concludes with a hopeful message for rain. Don't forget that the arch of this film is they can't afford to hire a water diviner. So they decide they're going to dig a well, and the well be successful, and then it dries up. They can't get water, and they don't have the resources to bring water in. So this lullaby occurs as a sort of almost a prayer that rain will come.
Simple, isn't it? Beautiful, melodic.
It is. It's deceptively simple, I think. As I say, it's a lullaby, but it's also a hopeful message. And it's sung by the mother in the film, Yeri Han. It's beautiful.
I guess it brings us to something finally that I wanted to ask you about, which gets at an idea in this film, and I think it's something you've said sort of characterizes all of the five films that we've been talking about, that, as you say, these are ordinary people in situations where they have to do something, what? Extraordinary, I guess.
Yeah. It is. And each one of these scores stands alone, as we've talked about, because of what it does. Hard to really hear this music without knowing the films that they belong to. But at the same time, awfully nice to have seen the films and then go back in time when you hear the music again. But that is true. I think whether you look at the Manc jazz or the soul jazz, where some of the sounds can perhaps get a bit more in your face, as it were, there is a passive quality in the scores this year, which I did not hear this last year, and so I'm hopeful that this is a trend that we're going into right now, which is making the music so specific to a scene and a film that it can't be long. You could not take, you could not really take Minari and put that music anywhere else. You couldn't really take News of the World and put that in another Western. You might, but you wouldn't be doing anybody any favors. The Defy Bloods stands alone as a score that reflects both the hopes and sadness of a generation who fought in Vietnam. Each one of these films stands alone, in my opinion, and each one of them deserves to win an Academy Award. And I know we say that in competition, Doug. I'm sure you and I both, when we host competitions and what have you, everyone's a winner. We know that. But this year they are. They're all five winners, but they can't all get an award. One of them's going to have to win.
You want to venture a guess?
When I think in terms of the nominations, I think there's an excellent chance that Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross will be picking up their second Academy Award, because the exceptional films of Mank and Soul just make it so. And so when you've got those two films, very different films by the same people, except one Soul also adds John Batiste to the roster of nominees, the Academy has to vote for one. I think they may take a step toward creating a broader musical palette, and I think they'll invite John Batiste to join them on stage with the award going to Soul.
Edmund Stone, thank you so much.
Doug, it's been a pleasure. Let's do this again soon. Thank you.
Edmund Stone. His radio program is called The Score, and you can find it on all classical public media in Portland, Oregon. We'll put a link to it on our website. And you can watch the Academy Awards on Sunday on ABC starting at 6 p.m. Mountain Time. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.